Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the geek show's dedicated comic book, manga, graphic novel, graphic literature, cave paintings of Lascaux, I don't know. We're a podcast that deals with comics and manga. That's all you need to know. My name's Rob, and joining me today, as always, is Andrew.
Hello.
And at some point, we may or may not be joined by another Rob. Right now, he is definitely shroning as Rob.
Hello, hello, hello.
Oh, he's not?
Wow. That is some amazing timing.
That is superb timing. That is absolutely superb timing, Schrodinger's Rob. We were just speculating on whether you were going to be joining us today or not.
The overlords that is the internet kind of... they weren't really decided which way that was going to be.
Andrew, what are we doing today?
Well, today you may as well call us My Shelves, because we are packed wall-to-wall with comics and, oh God, are definitely going to collapse at any moment. By which I mean, we've got lots of comics, so we're going to just talk about them for a show special.
I like these specials. So who wants to go first?
I can if you want.
Go for it.
Let's see, first, I want to talk about Tales of Suspense, featuring Hawkeye and the Winter Soldier. And it's like a one-shot, so it's like one story all in. It takes place after, is it Secret Wars, where Hydra basically takes over S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D.'s no more, Hydra's no more, it's just a whole mess.
Oh, Secret Empire, you mean?
Yeah, that.
Yeah, with Nazi Captain America.
Yeah,
no, Bob, they weren't Nazis, they were a legally distinct group, and any political implications you draw are your own.
What Andrew said.
They weren't, they were definitely Nazis.
In this, though, it focuses around Black Widow and Natasha Romanoff as being killed, and Hawkeye's having doubts that she is actually dead, because apparently Captain America killed Black Widow all deadsies. Is that true?
Kind of.
I think so. That was probably a thing that happened in Secret Empire. But it's the very definition of drink to forget.
If it sounds true, it probably is, and just forget about it and move on.
Yeah, see, there's only two characters in the Marvel Universe who would basically just turn around to the reader through the comic and acknowledge the fact that it's Black Widow, she's popular in the movies, she's not going to stay dead, and then just move on.
Hmm.
And that's Gwenpool and Deadpool.
Well, yeah, they're in the Eye of the Beholders, whether you like them or not. But it starts off with Hawkeye. He's at a funeral. Let's just say the funeral goes badly, and he ends up setting the funeral parlor on fire, killing a few people.
I think that is the definition of the funeral has gone badly.
Yeah. But he doesn't get arrested because he has an Avengers card, so he just flashes that and he's okay.
Is this like some weird get-out-of-jail-free card? I'm a member of the Avengers.
For Hawkeye, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's sort of sassy for Hawkeye as well, like he was written by Matt Fraction, sort of like this version of Hawkeye. And the whole point of this is it's basically like a buddy spy movie, but it's got like Hawkeye and the Winter Soldier, who really don't like each other, trying to find Black Widow.
Oh, God. You're making this sound like... Do you remember that... Was it the Eddie Murphy and that blonde... That Eddie Murphy, Owen Wilson film?
No, it wasn't Owen Wilson. It was... I can't remember what it was, but it's 48 Hours.
No. It was Eddie
Nick
Murphy.
Nolte, isn't it?
No. You guys are thinking of the wrong movie.
There's the good Eddie one, Murphy. Yeah. We're thinking of. You're thinking of a bad one.
Yes, I know. I'm thinking of the bad one. But that was a spy movie. Nick Nolte's one was just a stakeout movie.
Well, yeah, but it's a good one, this. I really, really enjoyed this. Because, you know, it plays off the whole idea of a buddy cop thing is usually it's two very conflicting personalities. It's got a Winter Soldier who's basically just being moody all over the place and brooding. And it's got Hawkeye basically throwing horrible sandwiches at guards in the street.
I've got to ask, at any point does Hawkeye say, I'm too old for this?
No, he doesn't.
Okay.
No, he doesn't at all. But it's got this weird thing, you know, and it changes narrator. There's only four issues in this, so it's quite succinct. But it changes narrator. The first one's for Hawkeye. The second one's Winter Soldier. And let's be honest, she's not dead, is she?
No.
What?
But she's not dead, but she is dead, but she's not dead, but she is dead. You know, yeah, superhero logic. But yeah, in the third chapter, it takes Black Widow's perspective. And it includes stuff like the Red Room. If you don't know the Red Room, it's basically who taught Black Widow how to be Black Widow. And yeah, it's got also got like a talking bear. And that's a weight in my heart feature, a talking bear, and I'm yours. But yeah, it's like a good old-fashioned caper, this. I really enjoyed it. It's by Matthew Rosenberg with art by Travel Foreman, which I don't know what that is, and Rochelle Rosenberg.
Okay.
That's very nice as well. It's nothing that's going to win any awards, but it's just a sort of art where you know where everything's supposed to be. It's got like a nice flow, very clean lines. Every character's is like stand out as they should be. It's got great sense of building scenes as well. So it's good just by doing everything. You know what I mean? It's not flashy in any way. It's just good, solid art. And it's a really fun story with characters that have like a really nice chemistry to them. And it ends on a really intriguing gambit as well, which works especially well when you're talking about sort of spy capers. But yeah, that's really, really fun, I think.
Hey, speaking of ending on a really intriguing gambit, I'm going to go next now because I've been reading Rogue and Gambit.
Yay! Oh,
I didn't set him up for that, by the way.
You didn't, but I saw the opportunity and I had to take it. So this is written by Kelly Thompson with art by Perry Perez. And it's a five-issue miniseries looking at Rogue and Gambit as they get drafted by the X-Men to take part in this mission where they have to infiltrate Isle Paradiso, a mysterious island where mutants keep going for couples therapy and then mysteriously disappearing.
Club Med for mutants.
Basically, yes.
Oh.
Do you know what?
What?
This series is really freaking good. Because I love, because all this, like, Al Paradiso stuff, this is more just the setup and kind of the backbone to the series.
Yeah.
And the main meat is just, it goes really in depth into these two characters who, like, keep getting into this on and off again relationship. It sort of really explores why they keep coming together and why it keeps failing. And it's just, it's really cool to see, especially a superhero comic that goes like this in detail with its character work.
Mm,
that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, whilst also having some like really kick-ass action scenes.
Awesome.
And I like that, that there's always lots of little flashbacks to sort of previous stories.
Hmm.
So lots of the art. Like there's one bit especially I love where it's kind of their first counselling session and they're kind of having an argument about all the things they've done to each other. But instead of words, actually in all the speech bubbles, it's actually just panels from like various stories.
See, that's
they've
cool.
They've got things like Gambit kissing Storm and Rogue kissing Magneto, and that one time both of them got stabbed with a big old sword.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember that one time.
Yeah, that was a bad series, unlike this one.
Yeah. See, that to me is sounding. You remember the couples therapy that Hawkeye and Mockingbird went through that was highlighted in Mockingbird?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically, imagine if that was like an entire miniseries.
Yeah.
And off the starred Rogue and Gambit.
See, that's what I was thinking.
Question is, though, is it sort of an X-Men hardcore thing? Because you made it sound like anybody could sort of dip in and get some from that there.
Yeah, they would say it's essentially, it's pretty easy to read as a first time. Like, you get a good idea of who Rogue and Gambit are. But I think it probably works a lot better if you do know these characters.
Yeah.
Well,
if you do have some awareness of, oh yeah, these two, like, they have this on and off again thing and they fight a lot.
Yeah. I mean, if you know just a little bit about their history, because they've been paired up for a long time, haven't they?
Yeah, well, ever since like the 90s.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're getting it, you know, you start heading into kind of Superman Lois Lane territory after a while, and Rogue and Gambit are basically in that territory now.
Yeah. Just actually saying that, that reminds me, I think a lot of people probably can get into this because I assume if you're picking up an X-Men comic book, that means you more than likely watched the X-Men animated series in the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which means you'll be at least be familiar with Rogue and Gambit as characters.
That's such a long time ago, though, let's be fair. And if any universe needs a Thanos snap, just to make it a bit more simple, it is the X-Men one.
Oh, he's still so young, Andrew. He doesn't know what DC was like before Crisis on Infinite Earths.
No, I mean, what's accurate?
DC are bad, but they also do not have the Summers family tree.
Oh yeah, this is true.
So many clones and time travel.
Yeah.
I loved X-Men as a kid, and I still like to think I do now, but the comics are just so scary. That's what I was getting at. You know, Thanos comes in, snaps his finger, it just cleans up the continuity a bit. That's what I was getting at.
Do you know, I saw a brilliant panel one time, and it was somebody had basically done a comic book panel as if it was from like an 80s or from like a 90s comic. And it had, what's Scott's dad called again? He's the leader of the
staff. Corsair.
Corsair. Had Corsair telling like Scott Summers, who was on board his ship, to clean his room. And Scott's going, "But dad." And they called the panel Last of the Summers Wine.
Well, I think the one which sells it better is actually a genuine panel from a comic book. I think it was one of the Novas, where the Nova, who was in like the Cancerverse for God knows how long, comes back to Earth, and then Miss Marvel explains who everybody is. Says, "This is why I don't like coming back to Earth." It's just convoluted to all hell. And just the perplexed look on Nova's face. It's like, yeah, well, there we go.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Nova. Anyway, this is really good. I think what my favourite thing about this is like Kelly Thompson writes Rogue and Gambit as a believable couple. Like, it's not like, I don't know, Sabian's way sitting there thinking, why do these two even want to be together? Like, in this, you genuinely can see, oh yeah, these two have some issues, but if they can just work it out, then, like, you see how they work as a couple.
Yeah, I see. I mean, because, like, Farr and Jane Foster, I don't understand that. They've never really done a good job of that for me.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of relationship where you can't understand what do they do outside of adventures.
See, yeah. The interesting thing was the relationship between Thor and Jane Foster was actually a more understandable and more believable relationship during the time that Jane Foster was Thor.
Yeah, exactly. But
before then, it didn't make any sense.
So anyway, Rob.
Yes, I'm going to stick with the Marvel, and I'm going to get the bad one out of the way and slowly work my way through my rehabilitation from Legion. And this is The Legion by Peter Milligan with art by Wilfred Torres for the first three issues and for issue five, and Lee M. Ferguson for issues four to five as well. Now, first thing I'm going to say before I even get into this is, my God, David Haller. Is it Haller or Haller? I think it's Haller. I think it's pronounced Haller. But my God.
Oh my God, I've watched two seasons full of Legion and I actually have no idea where I was.
Yeah,
David. Yeah, I would say Haller.
Okay. My God, David Haller, what is with your hair? It looks like someone has perpetually goosed him. Anyway, the artwork in this is particularly not good.
Good explanation.
Well, let's put it this way. I know that Legion is supposed to be insane, and technically you could get away with all sorts of weird and wacky stuff.
What is Legion? I've never heard of this guy.
Legion is David Haller, and David Haller has multiple personality disorder, schizophrenia.
Yeah, we are Legion.
Yeah, he's got multiple personality disorder. He's schizophrenic. He's schizophrenic with dissociative identity disorder.
And is he like X-Factor in the DC universe?
Is he like what?
He's in the Marvel universe, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm talking Marvel. Legion.
Is he the guy who can like create multiple versions of himself?
No, that's Multiple Man.
Independent.
That's Multiple Man. Legion is
different.
It's
so confusing, Rob.
But yeah, I know. I'm trying to explain Legion, so be quiet and listen. Okay? Try to work through my therapy here. I had to read this. You didn't. Okay.
No.
So Legion is on the run at the beginning in this... in this comic book of horrible artwork.
Oh, but also just to finish, because probably Rob isn't going to explain after all that. So Legion's thing is he has multiple personality disorder, and like each one of his personalities has a different superpower.
Yeah, and also
he's overpowered.
Yeah, and also his base power is warping reality.
Yeah, he's a bit overpowered there.
Yeah, He can bend reality in it, when he's David Haller, and when he's one of the other characters, one of his other personalities, he has other abilities. So he is literally the most overpowered character. And isn't he Xavier's son? Is he still Xavier's son in this?
Yes, he is.
Ah, he's the dude with the Guile haircut.
Yes. And that's why my first question is, what's with the haircut? But anyway, this trade paperback has very, very, very just not good artwork. And I'm using the phrase not good because I don't want to say all over the radio.
You mean like what you have just done?
Yes, I know. But Rob can bleep that once. I would be saying it multiple times. And I don't want to do that to Rob. But anyway, he's being chased by Lord Trauma, who is another one of his personalities who appears to have broken out from his mind and is now attacking him in the real world. He gets picked up by an old Amish couple and taken to a hospital. So I'm just going to leave you to think about the fact that Legion, so David Haller, has been taken to a hospital by an Amish couple.
All I'm thinking of is basically he's Roy Jiffin, American Dad.
Now that you've said that, I'm actually thinking that's a good point.
See, this is all okay, because what actually happened is that back in about 2012, Cy Spurrier wrote a really incredible Legion series that ended with David Haller wiping himself from existence.
Yep.
Therefore, this comic book does not exist, but Rob is saying nothing. It's just all static.
Yeah, it's all white noise, and when you come to edit this, Rob, that's all it'll be. But anyway, Legion decides he's going to try and get Dr. Hannah Jones, who's a psychotherapist, and he's got to try and get her to help him, but Lord Trauma is on the hunt as well, and he knows what Legion's got to do, so he goes after the good doctor first, and then Legion comes to help, and blah, blah, blah. Now Hannah Jones is in a coma, and she's stuck in Legion's mind, and she's going through all Legion's different personalities and meeting them and psychotherapizing all of Legion's different personalities and making friends with them and blah, 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 until the ultimate conclusion. And I'm not going to tell you what's going on because, hell, this is supposed to be a comic about mental health, yeah?
Guess so.
But, well, here's the thing. You'd think it'd take it a little bit seriously, but it doesn't. At no point while I was reading this did I think, that's quite interesting. Oh, actually, they're taking this quite seriously. All the way through...
I'd say what they did in the Cy Spurrier run.
Yeah.
Seriously, beat the Cy Spurrier run.
In this one, they just take this flippant attitude to things like schizophrenia, things like dissociative identity disorder, past traumas, other mental health issues. There is a very, very flippant attitude taken in this until the very end, which is slightly bittersweet, the ending, you know? But, and ultimately left me feeling unsatisfied because I just kept feeling there's a lot of things you could have gone into. There's a lot of angles you could have gone into. You have a psychotherapist stuck in Legion's mind. There are so many ways you could have gone with the story, but no, you had to make it a straight-up punch-up between Legion and Lord Trauma, who's one of his personalities.
You see, and all you said, this is basically just white noise because after Cy Spurrier's run, Legion doesn't exist. But it's basically just white noise because there's just nothing interesting about it whatsoever.
No, there isn't. It's tedious.
Yeah, it does sound very bad.
Well, let's put it this way. Lord Trauma, this is no word of a lie, right? Legion has multiple personalities, yeah? Lord Trauma has somehow become so powerful, he can basically turn Legion's different personalities into these, he can basically subsume the different personalities and turn them into monsters, like zombie-like monsters, in Legion's mind. And he's going to do that to all of Legion's other personalities until he's the only personality left.
Here's a question, right?
See, that sounds like a really interesting metaphor that I bet they in no way do anything with.
No, because they left it as a straight punch-up between Legion and Lord Trauma. And let's put it this way, right? If these are different personalities of Legion, right, and they're left and reflect different aspects of his psyche, whether they're monsters or they're human doesn't matter. Killing them would harm Legion, yes?
Yeah.
So, What do other personalities of legions do? One of them is a hunter. Start shooting them in the head.
Right, here's a question.
Yeah?
I know there's some good writers at Marvel, but, you know, sometimes I feel like I could become a writer at Marvel because it seems like they're giving anybody a comic book. The stories are...
Well, no.
They're worse. They're very bad.
If anything, this is, I think, like the opposite of that. Because Peter Milligan is actually, he's done a lot of work for Marvel in the past. And he's been quite well regarded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is something they do from time to time, where they get someone who, to be honest, is very likely past their best. And just like trying to roll them out as, look, we've got a big name on this thing.
Yeah.
Explains a lot.
It's, you know, the difference between fake strawberry, you know, the taste of strawberry milkshake. Yeah. And you know the taste of strawberries, right? If you use fresh strawberries to make your own milkshake from scratch, it would taste very different to how the strawberry milkshake tastes, yeah?
It's a weird analogy, Rob.
That's what this comic book is like, right? It's basically that fake strawberry taste that you get in those cheap-ass milkshakes instead of the taste of real strawberries that you get in a real, you know, strawberry food.
Let's go with that. Rob, you talk about another comic.
Yeah.
One that makes me less sad on my insides.
I'm going to break the run of Marvel by talking about something manga from Japan.
Let's be fair, Japan is slowly taking over the world.
Well, maybe. And this is from Akiko Higashimura, the author of Princess Jellyfish, which, as I understand, it's a bit of a show favourite.
It's superb. And
we do like some Princess Jellyfish.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
This is the follow-up, which is called Tokyo Tarareba Girls. And the only way I can describe this is basically kind of like a romantic comedy.
Okay.
The gambit is the lead character, Rinko, is 33. She's a screenwriter in Japan. And she's single. She's 33. And the thing about Japan is the kind of look at anybody over a certain age who is married is kind of a spinster and sort of a... kind of socially isolated and looked down upon. It's like a much bigger problem it is over here in the West. It's like a major thing over there in Japan, isn't it, Rob?
Yep.
Yeah, I think that they are a fan of their traditional gender roles.
Yes, they are. And even though it's a romantic comedy, and historically, let's be honest, I hate romantic comedies. I kind of love this. The comedy aspect, for one, it's just very well set up. You know, it goes through misunderstandings, and when it's got like a this hit for the misunderstanding, it'll have like a lightning bolt coming down and basically exploding the building. It's like very big, like romantic, not big overblown reactions.
Yeah, that's something that manga do very well.
Yeah. It's got the three leads basically getting drunk all of the time. And one of the sort of side effects of Rinko getting drunk is she'll start, when she's like utterly wasted from drinking beer in her best friend's bar, and she keeps on scaring away the clientele because they're too loud. She'll start having these dreams about sort of like candy, I guess you call it, like sweets, Japanese sweets, traditional Japanese sweets.
Yeah.
They'll start talking to her. And it's really dark, this, because, you know, bearing in mind the whole Japanese thing about being married at about a certain age and the very traditional gender roles, like Andrew said, it has the little candies going, what if, right? And asking all these really harsh questions. It's just very brutal when you think about it. And that's the great thing about this. It's very charming. It's very sweet. All the characters are fantastically rounded. I mean, the main one, it's mainly her story. Everybody else is sort of supporting characters in this first book. But she's very well drawn. And she's funny. She's charming. She's clearly suffering from depression. But it's not too much of a sad sex character, which other series have kind of depicted depression as.
Mm.
Let's be fair. There's a bit more to it than that. But yeah, it's very funny as well, like I said. But generally speaking, it's just sort of the flaw, really. It's telling the same story that a romantic comedy would do. Early on, there's an interaction with a... Well, let's just rewind a little bit. Like, one of the things that they do in this is where they depict the world, where the author Higashimura depicts the world. She depicts it as sort of Japan as I think the best parallel would be sort of, you know, when you think of America and it's all hot young things and studio incest and really stupid people getting at the top because they sleep with the right people. And they're dressed like basically the most fashionable, stupid idiots imaginable.
That sounds a lot like Japan.
Yeah, it gets that idea across. And this guy who comes into the pub, like I mentioned, he's basically like a hot young thing. And he's brutal to Rinko and her friends. And that's the establishment of the through line. He, in the romantic comedy, would be the guy who, there's the meet cute, the interaction in the cafe. And they become closer and closer. But in this, the way it twists that is they both kind of hate each other. But they acknowledge the fact that they hate each other, but they hate the industry, but they hate each other. So it has like this nice little cycles to it. Whilst also being very emotionally raw, very emotionally true. Which I think is one of the things that a lot of romantic comedies don't get or understand, really, that the people who they're supposed to be depicting are characters and real, it's supposed to represent real people.
Yeah.
In this case, I feel like it's very close to the knuckle and very real and very authentic to what's happened in the author's life, maybe her friend's life. She alludes to the fact that it's to do with some people who were in their life, but she doesn't say whether it's her or not.
With her being in manga, she wouldn't be. She might be associated with scriptwriting, maybe.
But you never know. That's what I mean. It's kind of left open. She's not said one way or the other. I know, but you can tell it's coming from a real place.
I know she's a single mom, so
yeah, you can tell it's coming from a real place. And I think when you're telling a story about sort of finding value in yourself, that matters a lot, I think. And also the comedy also makes it incredibly readable. Like, I finished the first one today, and I wanted to just pick up the second one and go straight ahead because it has that sort of thing which I don't think enough manga do these days, really, where it's just eminently readable. It's very clear. It's even though the fact it's basically mostly dialogue driven.
Yeah.
Not a lot of panels that don't have like some dialogue going on in it, but it's just very, very readable. I mean, the last time there was a manga like this, which was just so dense with dialogue, was Great Teacher Onizuka, and I just hammered my way through that as well. I'm not going to compare this to Great Teacher Onizuka because there's just nothing alike, but it's just that sort of sense of I want to continue reading this, I don't want to stop, and that's a great sign of any book, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple of things I know about Akiko Higashimura. Just to follow on from what you said, Rob.
Yeah.
By the way, I'll bring Princess Jellyfish, the first volume, so you can have a read of that because it is wonderful.
I mean, this has that sort of surreal embellishments.
Yeah. So. Princess Jellyfish has that as well, but Princess Jellyfish takes a look at the whole otaku culture, but from a completely different angle to something like Genshiken and that, where they're basically focused on like video game and anime and manga otaku. With Princess Jellyfish, the girls, well, the young ladies, they're otaku about, well, Andrew, how best would you describe it?
Weird stuff.
One of them's an otaku about old men.
Yeah. Going to this, though, one of the things I really like about it is, though, a lot of the female characters in manga are kind of, they're very typecast in roles, aren't they?
Yeah, it's one of Higashimura's best traits is that she doesn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, these feel like you could pass these people on the street.
Yeah.
Like, they're genuine. And that's what I was kind of getting at earlier. She's like a really, really good writer.
She is.
Yeah.
Not only that, another thing I know about her, right? Urusan Aoki. Right, he did a documentary series where he was going around and meeting other manga authors.
Yeah,
and he was filming them at work. It was a brilliant series for anybody who's interested in the in that side of the industry. I watched every single episode, and the surprising thing was when he filmed Higashimura, the speed that she draws at is
excellent as well.
Her art is excellent, but the speed that she draws at is ridiculous. She basically goes and creates panels within minutes.
Oh, wow.
You know.
Just one last thing, though. I think the mark of a really good writer is somebody who can take a genre that you traditionally hate and make you fall in love with it. And she's done that with great ease, I think, here. Yeah, moving on.
Cool. Moving on to something completely different. I think we've had enough of a break from Marvel, but diving back in. Because I have been reading Astonishing X-Men Volume 2, A Man Called X. I'd say it like that because it is very like James Bondy spy title. Right. much like the first series, this is written by Charles Soule, with a whole bunch of different artists, including Phil Noto, Paolo Sequeira, Matteo Bufagni, Eiko, Ron Garney, and Gerardo Sandoval. So this follows on from the end of Volume 1. Slight spoiler, but probably not, because it's been pretty heavily featured in Marvel's advertising. Professor X is back. Yay. Is he?
What happened to him? Where'd he go?
He died, but then he got better, and now like his spirit is possessing the body of a dude called Phantom X.
And is this that Phantom X that I'm thinking of? You know, that Phantom X?
Yes. Professor X is now a sexy French art thief.
Oh, wow.
Because that's comics.
I was very, very worried.
So he's back and he's got to team up with the X-Men, because guess who else is back? It's only Professor X's unstable reality warping son.
Oh, you mean Legion?
No, I mean his other one.
How many kids has he got?
He's got two. He's got Legion and he has got Proteus, who is also like all powerful and potentially world destroying.
Yeah.
Because Proteus's thing is he is basically, he can warp reality like Legion, but also he's sort of like made of energy and he needs bodies to survive, so he can either like, you know, possess a host body or sort of like just live as an energy form, but needs to like absorb people's life essences to keep surviving. Either way, like the basic thing is he needs to kill people to survive, and he's going to be doing some of that unless the X-Men know how to stop him.
Ooh.
And I hope you're ready to buckle in for 6 issues of the X-Men going, oh, geez, we need to stop Proteus. What if we do this? Oh, wait, no, that didn't work because we're thundering dumbasses. Like, because Proteus's one weakness is metal, which longtime readers will know. It's kind of like the basis of a classic Chris Claremont story, which set up this whole, you know, Proteus. He's not necessarily evil, but just by existing, he's going to have to kill people. And so Colossus was forced to murder him.
Yeah.
It's a sad story. And one that they make reference to, and then yet also, like, forget all the lessons of. Because there's plenty of them standing around going, well, maybe we can rehabilitate him.
That's Marvel for you.
No, just bashes it in with a brick. That'll sort it.
Especially egregious. Because, like, they literally mentioned the story where they decided that, like, it's impossible to rehabilitate Proteus, so we have to kill him. And also kill him with metal. Metal, like the bullets, what Bishop has in his gun. But instead he decides he's just going to shoot Proteus with energy to distract him.
Why?
Because C-Point A, thundering dumbass. yeah, it's really annoying that the story is so kind of dull and drags on and on. And also I hate the fact that Professor X is back, because he doesn't have any purpose in these comics. Like, he is a character who was obsolete decades ago. Just let him be dead.
Yeah, and
the art is really nice.
On that, I know it wasn't the comic books, but Logan movie and Professor X in that, that's kind of like a very good final for him.
Yeah.
He's finished with the character. Just leave him for a while.
Yeah, comics should do that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, the art is spectacular. Like, I'd say the art's even better than it was in the first volume, because with Proteus, you've got lots of kind of weird world-warping things. It's like, it gives the artists some room to kind of flex their muscles. Like, there's a great bit in the issue drawn by Matteo, where, like, Professor X and Psylocke get sort of merged together. That's just this super creepy, like, Cronenberg-y horror stuff. And then there's the issue drawn by Eiko, which is, he's the guy, Rob, do you remember quite a while ago I talked about the Nick Fury miniseries?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did the art on that, and he is just spectacular. Like, he's got stuff that, like, literally looks like it's exploding off the page. And it's so bright and colourful, and I just cannot understand how he does not get more work.
Okay. Hmm.
But yeah, that's probably pretty much all the positive stuff I have to say on this series.
Awesome. So, is it my turn?
And I mean, also all the negative stuff, so if you want to talk about something else, go ahead.
Yeah, it's your turn then, Rob.
Right, I'm going to wash out the nasty, bitter aftertaste that Legion left in my mouth with, well, believe it or not, Jughead the Hunger, which is the Archie one that you guys left me with.
Well, you're the expert, so we thought we may as well...
I am not an expert on Archie. That's the last thing I'm an expert on. Anyway,
also, much more importantly, I couldn't really be bothered with it.
Exactly.
Jughead the Hunger was... Actually, it was a surprise.
Is that the werewolf one?
Yes, it's the werewolf one. It's the one where Jughead Jones is...
I'm sure his name is Jughead Jones.
Yeah. It's the one where Jughead Jones... Well, they've got this serial killer going around called... They're calling him the Riverdale Ripper or something like that. And nobody seems to know who it is. But Jughead Jones has an idea because it's him. He is the Riverdale Ripper and he is also a werewolf whose powers have started activating. He doesn't know what's going on and he doesn't know how to deal with it. He doesn't want to kill people. He thinks it just happens automatically because he's uncontrollable. And he's trying to avoid killing anybody. He's trying to avoid meeting anybody. But he just can't seem to stop until one evening he kills one of his friends from school after turning into a werewolf. Unfortunately for him, Archie saw him. And so Archie wants to talk to Jughead. But then Betty turns up. And Betty basically punches Jughead and starts beating him up and then pulls out a gun on him and said, I'm going to kill you now. And Archie is going, no, I must save my best friend who's a werewolf who killed somebody in front of me. Because
Hang on, good guy. This is like Archie, quintessential 1950s America is great, isn't America great comic.
Archie's come a long way since then, Rob. You're talking about 1950s.
I mean, last I heard of Riverdale, the Archie TV, Archie was forming some kind of militia.
Yeah. Anyway,
Archie's changed.
Yeah, I know. It's no longer the wholesome America that it used to be. Anyway, it turns out Betty is part of the a family that's been hunting werewolves for centuries, and she moved to Riverdale because she was keeping an eye on Jughead Jones, and if he ever activated as a werewolf, she was going to kill him. And so they've got their own clan. It's basically, what was that clan war in America again?
Oh, the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Yeah, it's basically the Hatfields and the McCoys, but throw in some werewolves as well. And so Betty's trying to explain her family history to Archie. Archie's going, I can't let you kill my friend. Wah, wah, wah. We'll try, you know, I've read that this plant can save him. And lo and behold, he turns into a werewolf, but then he turns back into a human, so maybe the plant has saved him. Or maybe he's just killed somebody and then run away, which is exactly what's happened, because Archie is a dumbass, right? I still don't know why Betty and Veronica seem to like Archie so much, but Archie is a dumbass. When are they going to learn? There are better men available elsewhere. Archie is a dumbass, and Archie will continue to be a dumbass, even when people are dying around him. Archie still whines about killing his best friend, you know, later on in this, which is not a spoiler because, well, it's comics and he's a werewolf. He's not going to die from something stupid like that. And so, yeah, it's...
Do you like this? It's kind of unclear.
I don't...
You're making it sound like you hate it.
I don't like it, but it's also difficult to hate it, right? See, this is the surprising thing. For me, is that I don't actually hate this. And normally, I would dislike a lot of the Archie comics for being far too cutesy. But anyway, you know, this basically ends in a strange way. It seems like Riverdale has more than one werewolf in town. But I'm not going to tell you who they are. But
the Punisher.
It's surprising because it's darker than I expected it to be. It's more bloody and gory than I expected it to be. Given that it's an Archie comic, I mean, and it's a lot more surprising in how it's playing out. I expected it to be a pretty straightforward Archie versus the werewolves affair. And, you know, it's all sweetness and light in the way that Archie, you know, the Predator-Archie crossover was. But no, it's not. It's nothing like that at all. It's basically an out-and-out horror, which is surprising. Mm. It does have the first issue as well in the back of this of, a bonus story called Vampironica, where Veronica Lodge is bitten by a centuries-old vampire and is now kind of a half-vampire high school cheerleader in the style of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, except she's also a vampire this time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I know. This is
the Archie comic for people who hate Archie comics.
I'd say this is the Archie comic for people who don't want to read any other comics other than Archie, but want variety in their stories.
Well, they have been writing it for decades upon decades, so you seem to have to do something to keep it fresh.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Archie comic for people who basically don't want to read Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or anything like that. They only want to read Archie comics. That's all they ever want to read. They're used to Archie. They don't like the newfangled characters with all their newfangled superpowers. Archie is the best, so trust in Archie. I'm saying don't trust in Archie. He's a dumbass.
Trust in Jughead, because he'll do you in.
No, he just eats a lot.
I don't know who any of these people are. I just know the names.
Moose, that's one of them.
Yes, Moose is one of them.
Right, is that it?
Yep, moving on.
I have my last one here. This is Captain America and Black Panther, Flags of Our Fathers, by Reginald Hudlin, Denise Cowan, Klaus Janson, Tom Palmer, Sandu Floria, and Pete Pantazis. And it features Captain America, Black Panther, Flag of Our Fathers, Want to Float, and Rise of the Black Panther 1. And the art in this is horrible. I'll just say, no, in the aesthetic sense, it just looks ugly. You know, it's very scratchy. It looks like sort of a practice run before, like, they do the art proper. And I think even more egregious than that is the fact that when there's an action scene, there's lots of them where I don't know what's happening, because the flow from one panel to another is just really hard to follow. So, like, there's one bit where Captain America's fighting, and then the next panel he's up in the air. Like, he's just... what happened there? How did that happen? I don't know what's going on. But this is the story of before Captain America was frozen in carbonite for 75 years. No, hang on.
You got Han Solo.
That's Han Solo.
Fine, they're all the same character.
They're all the same company now, so that might actually happen.
But this is during World War II. The Nazis want to go to Wakanda, take the vibranium. And they're led by Baron... is it Strucker or Stucker? I always get confused.
Strucker.
Strucker, yeah, with an R.
They're leading it on Hitler's behalf. And Captain America, along with the Howling Commandos, head to Wakanda and fight with the Black Panther. But it's not T'Challa. It's not T'Chaka. It's his granddaddy. Yeah, I said granddaddy. What was his name again? 1 minute.
Chanda or something like that.
It's not T-Dog. It's Azuri. His granddad Azuri. And it's just a story, you know. You know, the Red Skull and the Nazis have plans up their sleeves. They have superheroes that are just ridiculous, including, like, the worst superhero names. There's one who's just kind of like Power Man or something, just something so generic like that. I can't remember it specifically. There's a guy who's got no legs. It's no arms, and he just cannibalizes people.
Are you talking about the Armless Tiger Man?
Yes, the worst name for a supervillain, perhaps, ever.
his superpower is that he doesn't have arms. He just does good kicks.
And he's got sharp teeth. And it kind of just unfolds exactly as you expect it to, really. There's nothing surprising about it. The sort of narrator through it is a black member of the Howling Commandos, and his narrative kind of sets into motion how Captain America gets his vibranium shield. But I don't really have anything to say about it. It just exists.
It sounds like we've all had our version of the Legion comic, where it's just dull and tedious and has really bad artwork.
It's just really bad artwork.
Good artwork.
Sorry?
To be fair, Matt had, like, really good artwork.
Yeah, and this one has bad artwork where I can't actually follow what's happening in the action scenes.
You're so lucky, Andrew. I could have done with just some good artwork in that Legion one, but no.
And the other one, it leads up to the birth of T'Challa, really. It's got some of the story of the previous wives of T'Chaka. And that's it, really. It's kind of drawn out. I'll be honest, this is one of these what I don't know who it's for. I mean, Captain America fans, there's much better stories by far. Black Panther ones, again, by far, especially the current one that's coming out this year. So even completists, I wouldn't recommend it to completists, because it's just going to end up thrown up in a pile and you forget about it in like a day after reading it. I will.
Also, Captain America fans, there are much better characters to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pick a better character.
I'm funning you guys. You can like borrow an old Steve Rogers if you want.
You can take an old Steve Rogers. What was it? You can take an old Steve Rogers to water, but you can't make him drink.
Yeah. The sad thing is, Reginald Hudlin's running Black Panther. I absolutely adore. So this, I don't know what this is. So it's a bit of a letdown, really.
It sounds like he got his orders from Marvel and they said, do this or you're off the team. He went, all right, not my loss.
Yeah, but that's that. And it exists and blur. So next.
Okay, so my last one, I've been reading Stephen McCrane's Space Boy, which is published by Dark Horse.
Okay.
And right off the bat, I have one very serious complaint.
Oh?
This is, in fact, not about a space boy. It's about a space girl.
Okay.
Because this is the story of Amy, a girl who grows up kind of in the far future on a deep space mining colony, only okay, so... for her father to lose his job at the mine. And so they are sent back to Earth, where Amy has to kind of move into a new high school and try and learn how to fit in and sort of get over her own life, whilst also following this mysterious boy. He's the space boy, but he's also not that big a character in this volume.
Okay.
And did I make it sound like some kind of tawdry high school romance angsty thing?
A little bit.
Well, surprise, I'm not. It's actually fantastic.
What? Swerve.
Because the bit I neglected to mention is that this is set into a future where light speed travel doesn't exist.
All right.
And so the only way to get from the colony to Earth is to go into cryostasis for 30 years.
Ooh.
So, like, it's this big emotional story about having to adjust to the fact that, like, you go to sleep one day, wake up the next, and your best friend has, like, had their entire life. Like, they are now an adult. Like, there's a great bit where she kind of calls up her best friend on a video screen, and, like, she says, oh, hey, Gemma, it's you. And then the girl just says, like, oh, Gemma, oh, no, that's my mum. And it's just, it's heartbreaking. Because, like, that's the moment where she realizes, oh, like my best friend is basically a completely different person now. It's kind of like they're dead.
Yikes.
Mm, didn't expect that.
Yeah, I think it's like, it does a really good job of being, like, genuinely angsty. Like, when Amy is kind of sitting around crying, I can actually say, you know what, fair dues. You're actually going through some pretty big stuff. And I like that it is, well, actually, first of all, what I like about the kind of the school drama aspect.
Yeah.
Is it avoids a lot of the usual cliches. So, like, there's not a bit where she's, you know, like, bullied by the popular kids, or she trips over in the cafeteria and everyone laughs at her on her first day.
Okay.
No, it's just like, she goes to school, she does well in some subjects and not so well in others, and she meets a group of people who she becomes friends with. And I like that it's this more organic. Yeah, she's trying to, like, go through school and figure out who she is as a person, and also... but also having to deal with the fact that, like, she left her whole life behind. And that's...
Mm.
It's like, it's a story I actually managed to connect with, and, like, I both like and feel for these characters.
I'm surprised, because when I had to flick through it, the artwork, I didn't think artwork was particularly great.
Yeah, the artwork, it takes some getting used to, because it's sort of very manga-light-esque. I think especially because this series, it does read a lot like a manga.
All right.
Like a very, you know, high school teen comedy drama type thing.
Yeah.
And so the art's just, it's close enough to manga that it's kind of weird it's not. But also, it does do something I do like. Because one of Amy's things is she has, like, synesthesia.
Yeah.
So when she, like, she sees people, she gets, like, a flavor. And I think it does a good job of character designing, of making those make sense. It's like... her dad, to her, has the flavour of hot chocolate. And, like, he's this big, warm guy with, like, a massive brown beard. And, like, you know, that, like, it makes sense.
Awesome.
But also what I really love is that all this team drama stuff is, like, wrapped around a hard sci-fi premise. So you've got a lot of stuff about, like, having to deal with space travel when, you know, you don't have this conceit of, oh, yeah, we can just go faster than light. Because, like, there's this huge cosmic story going on in the background.
Okay.
Because one of the things is that there's a giant artifact floating in the middle of space. And so Earth has sent, like, a 300-year mission to it. So So like they had to build this like massive spaceship with it, basically an entire city inside of it, like basically filled it with astronauts.
Yeah.
Whose only job is to like basically have, and then their kids will have kids, and those kids will have kids. So that like 300 years later, those descendants can find out what is this artifact.
Do you know what the artifact is?
No, because this is only volume one. So at the moment, all we know is it's a big, weird, floaty egg thing. But also the mysterious schoolboy might have something to do with it.
You did say floaty egg, not floaty head.
That floaty egg. Actually, do you know what it looks just like?
What?
The spaceships from Arrival. You know, that film with Amy Acker.
Yeah.
Just like those.
Awesome.
Yeah, and then there's also some cool stuff about, like, virtual reality. Basically, everyone wears, like, VR goggles now. And, like, you can, you know, play, like, you know, holo chess or do classroom lessons where we're going to study a coral reef. So we're just going to create, like, a virtual coral reef within the classroom that you can explore. And that stuff is all really cool as well.
Wow. Like, awesome.
It's because ways in which future society is affected by technology is, like, one of those things I'm super into in fiction. And this, like, actually caters to that. This is very good. I would like to read more, please.
Awesome. I will... Oh, you were going to say?
I just watched Ready Player One recently and see somebody using VR, you know, like an authentic way. It's nice. It's nice to see that happen.
Well, there's a lot of things you can do with VR, and I'm surprised that they haven't.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway...
There's this kind of bait and switch. Well, first, because Amy doesn't put the goggles on, she's very, oh, everyone's wearing these VR things and they're so wrapped up within their own world, like no one talks to each other anymore.
Yeah.
But then she puts on a pair and realizes that, oh, no, wait, everyone is actually like more connected than ever. But they've all got like these little in jokes and kind of customized designs that virtual reality can give you.
Like, awesome.
It's a more balanced view of social media than most stuff which I like.
Hmm.
Which are normally three words that don't go together. Balance, social media. Balance and social media.
Okay, so closing us out, Rob?
Closing us out is actually volume one of a series from Cinebook. And this is by Ralph Meyer with art by Fabienne Velman. And this is Ian. It's a kind of a cross between a trade paperback and an actual comic book. Ian and Electric Monkey. And Ian is an intelligent artificial neuromancer, and he's basically he's been tasked with helping this military team achieve a specific goal. See, what's happened is the base that this military controls, they're actually part of a different part of this country, and the base has a problem because a whale crashed into it, and so they're trying to figure out.
Oh, I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, they're trying to figure out everything that's going on. Unfortunately, there are also terrorists at work and various things like that. Now, Ian has a problem because Ian, being an artificial intelligence, he's not supposed to have hopes and dreams or emotions or something like that until he's much, you know, much more improved, in which case they might give him those. But he's already started feeling things now and having his own opinions now. There's a lot of prejudice towards his kind. There's a lot of prejudice towards these artificially intelligent neuromancers. But I've got to say, I really enjoyed this, right? I actually do want to know what happens with Ian afterwards, because I found Ian himself to be quite a likable character. And the artwork in this is really, really good. You know, it's very detailed, especially the fine details. And you can... You know, the faces aren't exaggerated in any way. It's very colourful, but ultimately, you know, this ostensibly is a story about saving a whale. It ends up as a story about saving yourself and the people around you, for Ian, that is. There's not much I can say about it. I mean, there's not a lot to the story. It's very, very basic. That's why it's such a short trade paperback. It's more of an issue one than it is a full volume, and I don't like doing episode reviews. You know this.
So you think it's probably going to be something pretty good once it's got a few more volumes under its belt?
Yes. I think it needs those extra volumes just to give the first issue more context, because right now there isn't much context except for Ian is a neuromancer, an artificially intelligent neuromancer who wants a better life.
Well, we shall give that an official score of TBC out of 10.
Hmm. So, yeah, I will confirm that when I read the next one. If you've enjoyed the show, then you can find all of our other shows on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, or on our website where we have a range of other shows that might suit your taste. Try them out. You never know. We also have our shop, we have our Patreon, and we have all sorts of other things for you to enjoy on our site, thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or on our own Twitter, which is Andrew.
At Four Panel Podcast.
Or you can email us, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk.
I think on that dramatic cliffhanger ending.
Yes, we are at the end of the show. That's us for this week. So until next week, when we'll be back to business as usual, I've been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've also been Rob.
And we'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.